Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In her latest book, Llewellyn's Little Book of Halloween, Mickey Mueller discusses the history, folkloric traditions, and customs of the holiday, and even provides some spells and divinations that adventurous readers might be tempted to try. Mickey has been contributing articles and illustrations to Llewellyn's annual almanacs and datebooks since 2007, and her art has been displayed on the sets of the sci-fi channels The Magicians and Bravo's Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce. She is the author and illustrator of The Voice of the Trees, the illustrator of The Mystical Cat's Tarot, and author of The Witch's Mirror. She's also taught magic and folklore, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show on this Halloween to discuss the holiday and much more. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. Nice to talk to you. Happy Halloween.
And the same to you, I guess. I don't know. Is Halloween a happy holiday?
It is for me. It's my favorite.
You begin your book with the history of Halloween and its complicated evolution. You say its roots may go back as far as 5,000 years?
Yeah, definitely. It goes way back. We don't really know exactly how old it is. Of course, Halloween was originally known as Samhain, which is a Celtic festival of the dead and also a festival of harvest. And it was their new year. The reason that we don't know how old it is because the Celts didn't use a written tradition. They had an oral tradition that they passed down. So we don't really have any recorded history as far back as it goes. But we do know that the festival was old when it was first recorded in some 10th century manuscripts where they talk about the festival and some of the different traditions.
So, interestingly, it not only borrows from the Celtic traditions, but also ancient Italian traditions. So were they merged?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they did. It's really interesting how it all happened. Because what happened was the church was moving into Italy, and the people that were practicing their pagan practices there did not want to give up the festival of Lemuria, which was held in May. Actually, it was May 9th, 11th, and 13th, and it was a festival of the dead as well. And the people have a hard time giving these kind of festivals up because, you know, they're tied into their beloved dead and tied into a lot of things that scare them, and they, you know, they just don't want to give these things up because they feel like they have to, you know, keep doing these different rites and things. So what they did was they were having a hard time getting the pagan Romans to give up Lemuria. So they said, well, if we can't beat them, we're going to join them. And what they did was they created a new holiday called All Saints Day. And they did it right in the middle of Lemuria and said, okay, we're no longer going to be talking about and dealing with the spirits that you're dealing with on your holiday. We're going to focus on the saints. And in this way, they were able to get people to stop practicing these pagan things that they did. So then what happened was the church was having the same problem in the British Isles, and especially in the outlying areas, all the rural areas. They were doing the same thing. They were like, oh, no, Samhain's important. We're not giving this up, even though a lot of them had already converted to Christianity. So the church moved All Saints Day and brought it in to be the day after Samhain.
But
and
how?
So, yeah.
No, continue.
Oh, I was going to say, and so they were able to help to convert people a little bit better that way, to kind of basically transfer the ideas of one festival onto a more Christian festival.
But the holiday still retains all sorts of pagan ideas, ghosts, haunted houses, witches. How did they survive, or were they reintroduced later?
You know, it was a little bit of both, because what happened was, the witches actually are just tiebacks to the old pagan beliefs. So, you know, that's the thing. But at the end of the day, people, they could dress it up any way they wanted to, but people were still practicing a lot of these things. One of the things that, you know, they did was people would dress up. The ancient Celts would wear costumes because they were nervous about the fairy realm. And they, you know, they believed that these dark spirits were roaming the land and they wanted to confuse them. So they would dress up in weird costumes or put on strange face paint when they would do their travels around getting ready for the feast. And so this tradition was carried over into All Saints Day. They just had people dress up as their favorite saints. So it was just transferring that idea. The idea of the feast being an important part of Samhain ended up being transferred into the concept of souling, which was the church said, you know, here's what we're going to do. We know you guys are on board with All Saints Day, but some people still wouldn't give up Samhain because they were like, okay, we're all about the saints, but what about, you know, my aunt who passed away last year, and I want to still, you know, revere her and remember her on Samhain. So they also gave them another festival called All Souls Day, which was a time to remember your beloved dead, not just the saints.
Now we should point out that Samhain is spelled Samhain, doesn't?
Yes,
should be Samhain.
It should be. I teach a lot about the Celtic traditions, and I joke that they decide how they're going to spell things by just reaching into a Scrabble bag because none of the letters make sense. But and in the movie Halloween, the John Carpenter movie, they pronounce it Samhain as if it's like a person named Sam. But yeah, because it's Celtic, it's got a weird pronunciation. So yeah, it is actually pronounced Samhain.
Well, and the wars between religion and the older religions continued for a very long time. In the 17th century, the Pilgrims conducted the Salem witch trials.
Yes, exactly. And that was a whole thing. I actually was fascinated when I was in high school with the Salem witch trials because I was fortunate enough to be cast in a role in The Crucible. So I did a ton of research on it. And it's actually really an interesting topic. It's a very sad time. Most of the people who died during the Salem witch trials were not actually witches. And in fact, many people that were what we call, what witches called the burning times, most of those people probably weren't witches either. It was an easy way to go after someone who, you know, had land that you wanted or, you know, someone who you were worried was going to mess with your husband and stuff like that. It was just a really easy way to point people out. And yeah, it was just basically all about demonizing these old practices. But it was also, you know, a political move as
Well, the Crucible, Arthur Miller's play, is a political allegory. He was really writing it about McCarthyism. But it's interesting that that witches became the object in against the Pilgrims. Obviously, the concept of witches had remained alive for all of those centuries between the time when the Catholic Church started going after pagan ideas, wiping out aspects of pagan religions, and the 17th century Pilgrims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And they were, the people that moved to Salem were very, very uptight about all of that. They were terrified of it. But interestingly, there are other areas, like Virginia, where they were much more progressive, should we say, and they weren't as worried about things like, you know, the occult. They weren't as scared of it. And that's where Halloween in the Americas really took hold.
Hasn't the holiday had many names over the centuries? How did it come to be called Halloween?
Yeah, it has. Well, it started, of course, as Samhain, but then when All Saints Day became a thing, what happened was they began calling Halloween All Hallows Eve, because hollow means holy. And so sometimes it was All Hallows Eve or All Halloween. They had several different versions of that, and it was basically a contraction of the day before All Saints Day or All Hallows Day. And then it eventually morphed over time into just becoming Halloween. It just shortened over the years.
So, being evening.
Evening, exactly. And it's interesting because, of course, the Celtic holidays all began, well, the Celtic days all began at sunset. That was the way that they believed their day started, at sunset. So the evening part of it, it still ties back in to the fact that it all starts at sundown. And even today, you know, kids are waiting by their window looking, and is it dark enough to go out yet?
Now, is it a coincidence that Halloween, we mentioned All Saints Day, but also All Souls Day and Mexico's Day of the Dead all fall around the same time of the year?
Yeah. So what happened was, with the Day of the Dead, it actually used to be a Aztec celebration that goes way back. And it was the same kind of a situation where the church was like, we're converting everybody and we need them to fall in line. Only in this instance, they already had All Saints Day established. And so it was easier to move their Day of the Dead festival, basically, which was a festival that was dedicated to the Lady of the Dead, who is a goddess, an Aztec goddess, and her name I cannot pronounce, and I'm not even going to try because I would just butcher it. But what they ended up doing was moving all of the folklore and things associated with that festival, moved it to basically All Saints Day. So that's where Day of the Dead comes from. And it's all about making peace with death and remembering the ancestors. So it was actually a very similar concept to what was being celebrated, you know, in the Celtic areas as well. But their festival was in August originally, before it was moved to All Saints Day.
There were many ancient rituals that wound up being incorporated into Catholic ritual, and this is just
absolutely
one of them. Co-opting them was a good way of getting people to convert, I assume. But was Halloween ever banned in any part of the United States or the rest of the world?
Oh, yeah. There, and still sometimes people get, you know, a little bit uptight about it. But yeah, there are times that that the church was like, you know, this is not okay. And like I said, there's still, and I don't have like specific dates for you or anything, but it goes back and forth. It's like there's times when Halloween was okay with the church of the day, and there were times when they were like, oh, come on, you guys, you've got to stop all of these pagan practices and get on board with us. So yeah, you know, I know that, like, I talked to my father-in-law, and he grew up, back during the 50s and 60s, and he said, you know, all the Catholic kids, they had it made because they got All Saints Day off, so they could come around and cause all kinds of mischief and get all the candy they wanted, and they didn't have to, you know, go to school the next day because it was a holiday for them.
So in
some respects, that was useful.
Where is Halloween celebrated nowadays? Mostly in English-speaking countries, or is it all over the world?
There are a lot of countries where it's really starting to take hold now, more because I think because it's become so popular in America, and, you know, because of movies and TV and stuff like that, there's a lot of other cultures that are picking it up. But it's not celebrated anywhere as much as it is here, but there's a lot of... And there's also some countries that, you know, like Sweden and Canada, who've been celebrating it for as long as it's been celebrated, you know. But yeah, there's a lot of countries. There's a festival of, what do they call it? The Hungry Dead, I think. Oh, the Hungry Ghosts. And that's celebrated in Hong Kong. And it's very similar to Halloween, and it's celebrated at the same time. you know, in Belgium, they put chairs by the fire to remember their beloved dead and things like that. So there's, let's see, in Austria, they put food out. They put bread out for their dead as they, you know, come through. So there's a lot of places where it's celebrated, all in different ways. But it's not commercialized as much anywhere as it is here. Interestingly, in Australia, and again, there's townships that celebrate more than others, too, in a lot of these other countries. So there's like one town where, you know, they're like, oh, our town doesn't do anything for Halloween. And there's other towns where they'll have big parties and stuff. But in Australia, the pagans there celebrate Halloween, you know, in October, but then they celebrate Samhain in May because they're on the other hemisphere, and because that's how that all works. So it's very interesting.
Actually, and they're on the bottom of the world instead of the top of the world.
Yes.
Now, my guest on Leonard Lopate at Large today is Mickey Mueller. She is the author of Llewellyn's Little Book of Halloween, Llewellyn, because that's the name of the publishing company. Why is it said that the veil is thin on Halloween?
Yeah, it actually starts off with Celtic tradition, because the way that the Celts looked at things, they had a kind of different worldview. The in-between times were the times that were the most sacred. So that's why their day started at sundown. When the sun set, that was the beginning of their day, because these in-between times are the most sacred to them. Well, Samhain was a big in-between time, as was Beltane, which is May 1st. If you turn the calendar into a big wheel, those are both opposite of each other, Beltane and Samhain. And this is the time of the biggest shift, when we go from the time of the harvest to the time of there's no harvest and everything's gone from, you know, the earth. What we would call the dark half of the year. And then it changes again at Beltane, is that other shift. It would be kind of almost looked at as a hinge that the wheel turns on. And this is one of the reasons why we talk about it being the time of the thin veil. The other reason is because they were going into this dark time. Basically, it was the end of the harvest. And it was a time when people were really thinking about mortality, thinking more about their mortal bodies, because they might not make it through the winter, thinking about the people who passed the year before. And what the future would hold for them. So this was like a moment in time with a big shift. But a lot of the ways that we look at the new year as being, you know, people have a lot of Gregorian calendar new year, that we look at it as being a big shift where, you know, it's kind of like an in-between time, like that moment in time when you go from one year to the next.
And as you pointed out, Samhain was the beginning of the Celtic year.
Yes. They would pay their taxes. They would settle up debts because they didn't want to go into that dark half of the year when somebody might die having debts. And so they paid their debts and they did all these things. They would have a big feast. We have archaeological evidence that they drank at these festivals. It was feasting. It was bonfires. It was a three-day festival. And they also did divination magic to try to determine how the year was going to go. Ahead of them, you know, how there were tips and tricks from the spirit realm to help them get through this hard time. Because, of course, back then, you know, there was no running to the store for anything. What they harvested was what was meant to last through the year. So it was a scary time, but it was also a time when people celebrated.
Now, what about some of the symbols associated with Halloween? Spiders, bats.
Yeah.
Do they go back all the way to the Celts as well?
A lot of them really do. A lot of them do. When we think about bats, and it was interesting when I did some research on this, because I actually researched the life cycle of bats in the British Isles to make sure that what I was telling everybody was correct. But literally, the time of Samhain is right before the bats go into hibernation. So they were going through the same things as the Celts. They would have these big bonfires, of course, and the bonfires would draw in the last of the bugs, the big moths and the things that these bats needed to help get them through the dark half of the year as well. And so bats would be seen flying above the bonfires, snatching up those bugs. And owls, the same thing. And sometimes the owls would snatch up the bats. So that was the whole thing. Spiders, and, you know, a lot of people weren't sure why, you know, why spiders are associated with Halloween. We see them as, a lot of people see them as scary, but there's deeper meanings behind spiders. One of them being that when you visit a tomb or, you know, a crypt, that's where a lot of spiders live. It's a good place to catch bugs. It's a place where they can be undisturbed. It's just a perfect place for spiders to live. So spiders are associated with the dead, but also their webs are related to the interconnection of everything. So when we see a spider's web, it reminds us of the concepts of the past and the future and these things being all connected. So it's very interesting. There's also a little bit of folklore about spiders that if you see one on Halloween, it may be one of your ancestors checking up on you to make sure everything's going well. So don't smash them.
I was always worried about that.
Yeah, catch and release. Definitely.
Now, we can't discuss Halloween without talking about pumpkins. Pumpkins are indigenous to the Americas, so how did they become such a popular part of the tradition? Was there an earlier European version?
There was, in fact. And this was another thing that I had so much fun researching. Because in Ireland, what they carved were turnips. And these turnips, they would hollow them out with a little knife to tack away at them, and a big, probably mom's best big metal spoon, and they would hack away at these turnips and make a little face in them and light them with coal or a little stump of a candle. And when they would go out and do their shenanigans and turn carts over and play tricks on the neighbors, they would leave these turnips to try to trick people into believing that perhaps the fairy folk had actually caused the problem, and to scare people. It was kind of an interesting old tradition.
And didn't they use beets in other parts of Europe?
They did, there were big beets they used sometimes. And the important thing for Americans to know about the turnip is that if you want to create one of these yourself, don't go buy a turnip, because what they call a turnip in Ireland is what we call a rutabaga. They're much bigger. Turnips are small. And when I went to the store looking for one because I wanted to do it, I was like, oh, these are nuts. And I saw the rutabagas and I thought, that seems more the size I've seen in the paintings that, you know, the renditions I've seen of the original jack-o'-lantern. And then I did my digging, and I've learned that they are, in fact, rutabagas. So what we call a rutabaga is actually a turnip in Ireland. So, yeah. And pro tip, if you want to make an original, old-school jack-o'-lantern out of a rutabaga, cut the top off and then use a melon baller, and it makes quick time out of digging the insides of that out. It's the only way to go. Seriously. But what happened was when the Irish brought the Halloween traditions to America, they found these great pumpkins. They were big as a head. They were hollow already, so there was less digging out, and they were just the perfect thing. So they were like, forget it. We're not doing turnips anymore. We're doing pumpkins. And that became a real quick way to make a really cool jack-o'-lantern. And it's just been so iconic ever since.
And you even suggest ways of making those pumpkins last longer.
Yeah. I discovered some really great tricks. If you want to carve your pumpkins up to like a week ahead of time, you can. Using a little bleach water in a spray bottle will help to preserve that pumpkin and keep them from molding. Sometimes, and depending on your climate, they dry out. I used to live in New Mexico, and our pumpkins would dry out like crazy. But I found out that if you submerge a pumpkin in some water, a big bucket of water with a little bit of bleach in it, not a lot, just for like an hour, it'll reabsorb that liquid, and that pumpkin's going to last a lot longer.
Talk about tricks. How did trick-or-treating become associated with Halloween? Does that go back to the pagan days?
It actually goes, well, it was a feast day, of course. So the sharing of food was an important part of the communities back then. And then what happened was it changed a couple of times throughout history. The first thing that happened was on All Souls Day, people would go door to door. And the idea was that if the people that, the household beloved dead had passed on, and if they were nervous that these people hadn't made it all the way to heaven, and perhaps they were just kind of stuck in purgatory, and they wanted to offer prayers. Well, the church told them the more prayers for your people who have died, the better chance of them getting into heaven. So people would bake soul cakes. And what happened was the children and the poor would go door to door on All Souls Day. And they would offer prayers in exchange for these cakes. So they would pray for the beloved dead of the home, and they would give them a sweet treat to take with them. And that was kind of the first idea of the door-to-door treats. Now, what happened later was in America, a lot of the practices that got brought over from Ireland involved pranks. And these pranks got really out of control, and eventually, people were taking gates off of the fences and throwing them in the streets. But the things that they were really causing problems with was, sometimes houses were being burned down, trains were being derailed, and streetcars. And it was becoming not just a nuisance, but actually dangerous. And a lot of the towns got together and decided, we've got to do something to curb this. So what they did was they created these big parties where the kids could go, and they were dressed up in costumes, and they would have parades, and they would get treats like, everybody would get apples, and they would get, popcorn balls and things like that, different treats. A lot of times it was just pennies, coins and stuff, and people would offer them these treats. Well, eventually what they would also do is at these parties, after the parties, they would have radio contests. So the kids would have to run home and sit in front of the radio instead of going out and causing mischief. So trick-or-treat is basically payola to keep kids from vandalizing. So, all the people who don't want to give teenagers treats because they say they're too old for trick-or-treat, no. Give them the treats because it's a tradition, and they won't soap your house.
it's still odd that a holiday that began with thinking a lot about the dead has become largely a holiday where children have fun.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It is kind of interesting. But we have to consider also that the Celts didn't look at death in the same way that we do today either. And, they weren't as maybe terrified by it because they faced it on an everyday basis so much. But the other thing is, I think that part of Halloween is to laugh at death. We see a lot of humorous skeletons and humorous ghosts, and these are ways that we face our fears. And when you think about it, the Celts also were having a big celebration to face their fears of the winter that was coming. It would probably take a few people, but they, instead of being sad about it, they had a big party, and they drank and they ate and they feasted. And so that's kind of what we do, too.
We're talking about the history, the folkloric traditions, the customs, and even some of the spells and divinations of Halloween. They'll come up in a little while with my guest, Mickey Mueller. This is Leonard Lopate at Large. We're back with Mickey Mueller, whose latest book is Llewellyn's Little Book of Halloween, talking about Halloween with her. You write about your personal relationship to Halloween. Lots of people enjoy celebrating the holiday, but you've taken it to another level.
Yeah. It's kind of neat. When I was a kid and trick-or-treating, as a little kid, of course, we're all excited about getting to dress up because that's lots of fun. Getting candy, that's lots of fun. So who doesn't love Halloween? But when I was quite young, I always felt like there was something more to it. It always just felt, the air felt different. It's, it's almost hard to explain, but as a child, there was no reference for that. I've talked to a lot of people before and after I wrote the book about their experiences. And interestingly, a lot of people that I know who are witches, Wiccans, and pagans have also said that they also felt like there was something more to it than just the treats and the tricks. Like it felt like a very special holiday. Like there was something almost spiritual about it even back then. One of the things that I actually stopped, that I talk about in the book, was I actually stopped trick-or-treating a little bit earlier than a lot of my friends because of a neat experience that I had with my friend Lisa. We used our costumes as a way to keep us from being afraid. So we both dressed as witches one year, and we were scary witches. We were, you know, we were beautiful, fancy witches. We were terrifying looking witches, we thought. And there was one house where they had really decked it out. And this was back in the 70s. So of course there were no Halloween store. You could go buy things at. You had to DIY everything. And these guys had, it was terrifying to us. They had the black light in the door with the big sheets, and they were ghosts, and they had the loud music playing, and it was very scary for strobe lights flashing. And for all of us, we ran up and grabbed our candy, and we were so brave but we had so much fun at that house that we decided from that point on, we didn't want to trick or treat anymore. We wanted to be the ones answering the door and scaring the heck out of all the neighborhood kids. So that was our new tradition.
And that eventually led you into thinking about becoming a witch. The Pew Research Center conducted a study in 2014 that revealed 1 to 1.5 million people in America identify as Wicca or pagan. Does that mean they're celebrating some kind of religion? And what's the difference between Wiccan, pagan, and witchcraft in general?
Yeah, okay. Well, here's the thing. Yeah, it's very interesting that so many people now are finding this path. And it's especially interesting because pagans and witches, we don't try to go out and convert people. We just all do our thing. And if other people find that path and choose it, then that's, you know, great. But you know, you won't see us going door to door, other than on Halloween, maybe to get some candy. But it is a religion for most people who practice it. There are some secular witches, but for the most part, it is a faith. And the way that it works is witchcraft is the practice of performing magic, and many witches have their own faith that kind of almost styled in the way that they want it to be. They say that hurting pagans is, or trying to get pagans all together, is like hurting cats, because everybody has their own ideas or way of doing things.
Are we talking about cats or only black cats?
Oh, all cats.
Sorry, bad joke.
All cats are hard to get to do what you want them to do for the most part. But the way that it works is that paganism is basically an umbrella term. And underneath that umbrella term, we have different traditions. So there's Wiccans follow under that paganism term, as do, you know, Draga and eclectic witches and all these different basically pagan faiths that all fall within that grouping.
Are witches always women?
They're not. No. I know a lot of men who are witches. There are a few who use the term, who are basically like reclaiming the word warlock to use to describe men. But most of the ones that I know, the men are witches, women are witches. And yeah. I'm doing the thing.
I understand that you're a loyal minion to a dog. Why do we see animals so often associated with witches, especially the black cats that I referred to earlier?
Yeah, definitely. Well, one of the reasons is because our kinship with animals helps us to connect better to the cycles of the earth and to connect better with nature. Some people would call it familiar. They're like a go-between. They're our friends, our companions, but they remind us of a time that goes very far back when we were part of nature. And sometimes we get pulled away from it too so much because we drive our cars and we live in our homes and we're not as tied to the land anymore. Having animal companions can help us to connect back to that more primal time. Cats especially, because, and this is a very interesting bit of folklore, cats go back to cats and witches being tied together. Well, they go back as far as actually Egypt, you know, when we think about the fact that cats were worshipped in Egypt and they were big practitioners of their faiths that were all, that was, you know, all pagan faiths. But they, you know, cats could come and go as they pleased. Cats were worshipped, basically, and they will not let us forget that they were worshipped even today and still expect to be worshipped. But in Ireland, there's a spirit, bit of folklore known as a cat chi, and it's basically a fairy cat. And some people thought of it as a witch, and some people thought of it as a fairy. But the idea was this was a black cat specifically that had a little white tuft on its chest. And if you were to see this cat, you know, you weren't really sure what was going to happen because it was a spirit cat. But the idea was the cat could turn into a witch or a fairy and back, but could only do it 9 times. And that is where we get the cats having 9 lives. Mm. And it's also why black cats are associated with Halloween. It's because of the cat she.
Now, where did the image of witches having those pointy black hats and flying on brooms come from?
Ah, well, those actually both come from the old rural practices of the pagans. Those pointy hats are actually a reflection of the, back in kind of medieval times, the ladies that lived out in the rural areas, that was kind of the kind of hats that they wore. And so we have, you know, old like etchings and things. And so that's what artists have been depicting witches wearing throughout time. The broomstick thing is actually really interesting. During the old pagan times, they would have these bonfires and they would dance around the bonfire to raise energy for whatever spell work they were doing. And they would also do it as part of their festivals. And they would have hobby horses that were representative of spirit horses. And sometimes they would use brooms as well and ride them the way that a child would ride a hobby horse as part of their rituals that they were doing. And the other thing about the idea of them actually being able to fly on these brooms comes from something that they used, which is known as flying ointments. They were basically hallucinogens that would boost the shamanic state in which the witch could explore other realms of spirit and bring visions and things like that. So this was eventually translated in art as actual flight, whereas it was really more of a shamanic thing.
Shakespeare's witches in Macbeth foresee the future.
Yes, I love them.
But that's very different from the image we get of witches from most of the popular culture, the movies that we've seen, many of them being wicked, the witch with the poisoned apple in Snow White and the Wicked Witch of the West and the Wizard of Oz. And witches often are made to appear ugly and sinister.
Yeah, they definitely are. And that is the work of the powers that be that really kind of wanted to stamp down these pagan practices. When the church wants to paint somebody as being a bad person, the easiest way to do it is to make them appear ugly. And that was one of the things that happened. You know, back in the old days, the witches were basically referred to as the village wise women and cunning men. They were, a lot of times, they were herbal healers in these villages. They delivered babies. They would help with livestock problems and things like that. And the church didn't want them practicing their spiritual practices because they had a stronghold on that. So they were going to be definitely demonized because of that. But the other thing that happened was we saw the beginnings of medicine, you know, in the medieval ages and moving forward. And also the doctors didn't want these village wise women delivering babies, they wanted to be the ones doing it. So they also were very happy to get on board with these, the demonizing and basically, they're terrible. But one of the things.
Well, witches were early midwives, in effect?
Yes, they were. Absolutely. Yeah. A lot of those practices were tied together because a lot of what witches do is healing work and herbalism.
But they also cast spells. What is a spell, especially since you have some spells that you share in this book?
Definitely. A spell is something that's somewhat similar to a prayer. It's performed in a slightly different way. Basically, the idea is that there is energy that runs through everything. And the art of magic is to direct that energy into a positive change for your life. So it's just basically the idea of taking the energy that's all around you and programming it towards an end.
And how do you do that? I know you suggest using candles, but...
Yeah, a lot of people do candle magic. It's probably one of the most common kinds of magic. And I think that it's because fire is very primal, and it's something that's very transformational. And it goes back, again, to the very beginning of humanity. When we were able to harness fire, it changed us. And it made us able to move forward and basically create our culture, which we couldn't have done without the ability to tame fire. So it really is a transformative tool, candle magic is. And it all ties back to that. In a lot of pagan traditions, we consider the element of fire as being something that's attached to willpower and transformation. So candle magic is a great way to perform a spell. There's a lot of other ways, too. One of the most important things when anybody is doing any kind of spell work, or anything for that matter, is your intention. Your idea of focusing and being positive about the result that you want to have is key to making a spell work.
Now, you offer readers a spell that can be used to find true love.
Mm-hmm.
Have you received any feedback that the spell has worked and led people to fall in love?
Well, the book is fairly new, so we'll give it some time.
You want to share that with our audience?
Well, what I will say is I've written a lot of spells for opening yourself to love. And one of the things that I will say is this. If you're doing love magic, don't have a person in mind, because that's a terrible idea. You don't want to interfere with somebody else's will. And they might not be the one for you. You might think that they are. But the idea is to open yourself to finding true love. And that is the key to making it happen. Because if you open yourself to true love, it will find you, because you're more ready to accept it. I will say, I do know people who have used love magic in that way and had it work for them very well.
Well, how do we know if the magic has worked?
Well, exactly, right? The thing is, magic works in ways that we don't always expect. When we think about magic, the only experience that we have with magic is what we see in films and on TV. And it's really not like that. It's so much more subtle than that. So, you know, if I cast the spell, say, for instance, to get a new job, no one's going to come and knock on my door and offer me a job. You cast the spell to get a job. You fill out some applications, of course. That's part of it. And this is what we call the follow through in the real world. The idea is that the magic works through the path of least resistance. So if you're doing things in the real world, the magic will help it along. Now, what might happen is, and this is a good real-life example, if you do the spell to get a new job, you fill out several applications, and then you talk to your friend and say, oh, I filled out some job applications. And your friend says, oh, that one job is a really good job, and I know someone that works there. I'll put in a good word for you. And this is the way in which the magic actually works. It just takes the path of least resistance. There's no sparks flying. There's no, it works more in the way that we think of little miracles working.
But how is that any different than filling out the applications and talking to your friend without thinking in terms of magic and spells?
Well, the reason is that the idea is that the magic may have, because you performed the magic, you may not have really talked to your friend about, you know, doing this, you know, doing the application. Doing the magic shifts your mind to a different place. And doing the magic can also shift your mind to a better place when you're filling your applications out. It's really, a lot of it is about self-transformation. So when we make that shift and we apply magic, it can just help things move along in the same way that prayer can help things move along as well.
You also list some of the things that we can use to protect ourselves against other people's magic. Safety pins?
Yeah.
Mustard
safety
seed?
Yes. All kinds of things like that. There are certain stones and herbs. And it's not really just specifically to protect against other people's magic, because I honestly, most people who are doing magic are so busy doing positive magic for themselves, they really don't have time to run around casting curses on other people. It happens, but it's not as common as people might suspect. But the idea of these things is correspondences, and specifically sharp items have a certain energy. So it's basically the idea of the energy of that thing can ward bad energy from coming into your house, in the same way that some people would hang up a cross in the belief that that will protect you from negative energy. I do a lot of work with mirrors for protection magic as well. I wrote a whole book about mirror magic, and the idea is
because
that deflects the exactly, it reflects the negative energy away from you. And we see this in a lot of practices like feng shui as well, where people use mirrors to bounce good energy around or deflect negative energy away.
Is it true that during the spiritualism movement in the 1800s, some first ladies practiced witchcraft?
Well, they did do, maybe not witchcraft per se, but they did do seances in the White House. It was very interesting, actually. Mary Todd Lincoln was one of them, and Jane Pierce. Spiritualism had become huge during the mid-1800s, and people would have psychic parties, especially on Halloween, because traditionally, of course, this is the time when we think of the spirits being closer. And the philosophy of the time, people felt like it worked fine with the dogma of the Christian churches in those days, because they were talking about, you know, our dead would, people would die, but their spirits lived on. And so, you know, in the way that the church described it, they felt like that would work for them. So, yeah, they would have a seance or have their palm read on Saturday night, and then on Sunday they go to church, and they didn't see this as being a problem at all or at odds with each other. But yeah, there were two of the first ladies actually held seances in the White House. Tragically, they both lost children at an early age, and this was solace to them, you know, a way that they wanted to, you know, reach out and communicate and try to have proof that there's something beyond the mortal world.
You provide your readers with a tutorial on how to host a seance. Can't that be a dangerous thing to do?
Well, one of the reasons that I put that in the book is because I wanted to make sure that people know the right way to do it.
And Ouija boards, you also mentioned them. You say that people misuse them.
They do. They do. It's, you know, the way that a Ouija board works, and if you actually read, you know, the instructions it's given with it, you're really not supposed to use it to summon dark spirits into your realm. You know, the idea of it is you basically are really supposed to just ask the question and allow the answer to come. We think of this as being, a lot of people associate a Ouija board with a spirit is moving the planchet. But a lot of there's been a lot of research into it, and it's believed that it's actually the ideometer response, which is basically, if you touch the planchet very lightly, your fingers will slightly jiggle, and it causes that planchet to move. Now, this might sound like I'm saying there's nothing occult or spiritual about it, but that's actually not what I'm saying, because the way that it works is what we're doing is we're tapping into our own subconscious mind and creating these imperceptible muscle movements that are causing that planchet to move, and that's where our answers are coming from. It's not necessary to summon spirits into work a Ouija board. It's kind of a misnomer, and it's not really the way that you're meant to use it.
Do we relate that to Halloween?
A lot of people love to get the Ouija boards out and, as I say, play with them on Halloween. And again, with the Ouija board, there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. And I do suggest things in the book, ways to do it the right way so that you're not calling in anything that you don't want to call in. It's a basically magical amateur night as far as divination goes. It's important for people to, you know, have a little bit of good judgment, I think, when working with the spirit realm, which is one of the reasons why I put those things in the book, because I want people to be able to proceed without being fearful, because it's our fears that can really manifest bad things. So when we go through and we do a seance, or we use a Ouija board or a pendulum for that matter, or tarot cards, but we do it with a positive mindset, we're going to get a positive result.
You suggest some common household items that most of us have that we can use to do our own spellcraft. And most of them come out of the kitchen?
Absolutely. I'm a big kitchen witch. I feel like the kitchen is sacred space. And when we think about those old time wise women and cunning men who were doing their herbalism and healing work and spell work, they were all using things that they had in their kitchen. They were working with stuff that they had around their house. And I feel like that's a really important thing to do. The kitchen is the heart of the home. It's where we make meals for the people we love. It's where we use our creative energy to change a list of ingredients into something else. So we're kind of already doing transformational things in the kitchen. Every herb in your kitchen has a magical correspondence, believe it or not. Basil is great for money magic. Salt is a great purifier, spiritual purifier. Cardamom and cinnamon are both fantastic love energy. So when we think of these things that are in our kitchen, you can make magic with those things.
And we have to end it here, unfortunately, on a positive note and a tasty note. Mickey Mueller's book is called Llewellyn's Little Book of Halloween, published by Llewellyn. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. This was absolutely a pleasure. And happy Halloween and blessed Samhain to my witches out there.
And we in New York, we have this wonderful parade in Greenwich Village. I wanted to talk about that, but we have run out of time.
I know. I'm sorry. But I hope the parade is wonderful, and I love you guys.
And that does bring us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Mickey Mueller, to Kiki Valentine, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who helps things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.